I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. If you live in Texas and you are more than 6 weeks pregnant, even if you have been raped or are the victim of incest, it is illegal for you to get an abortion. Texas Senate Bill 8 was passed in May and went into effect on Wednesday when the U.S. Supreme Court refused to block the law, saying the abortion providers who challenged the law had not made their case. The law puts citizens in charge of enforcement, not the Texas state legislature, and incentivizes them with the possibility of getting $10,000 per case. They can sue clinics and any person who helps someone who wants to get an abortion after 6 weeks when a fetal heartbeat is detected. Coming up, we'll talk about some of the legal and constitutional implications of the Texas law and the Supreme Court's decision. Joining us now is Andrea Farigno. She is Vice President of Whole Women's Health, which operates 4 abortion clinics in Texas. And Andrea Farigno, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Are you turning women away from your clinics because it's post 6 weeks?
Unfortunately, we are. It's been quite devastating. We're still, our clinics are still open, and we're still having people come in so that we can assess whether they can receive services in our clinics or that having to give them information and referrals as to where they could go for care.
Did they know about the law change?
We've had a mixed situation. There's a lot of people that are aware, and they have expressed how outraged they are, how upset. It feels very confusing. I had a patient tell me that, you know, she found it incredibly upsetting and disrespectful that people that don't even know her are impacting her life in such a drastic way. And for some other patients that are not as aware of what's going on, they're more in a state of shock of not knowing why this is happening now, what difference, what changed, and not understanding the reasons.
Under this law, what can you tell someone? Let's say they're 7 or 8 weeks pregnant. What can you legally tell them?
Well, that is part of how this regulation is so upsetting. We have to be the ones to inform people of this law that we so disagree with it so wholeheartedly, and informing them what the process is, why this is happening, and giving information as to where they can go outside of the state of Texas. And so for that piece of the language of the law in terms of aiding and abetting, as long as the person is not having an abortion in Texas, it wouldn't apply to us.
So you can actually send them out of state and be in compliance with the Texas law?
That's correct. It's that would be within the parameters.
What's been the impact on the people that work at your clinics?
We are incredibly upset. It's very triggering. We have been in this situation before in Texas, which is really unfortunate. This is very similar to what happened a few years ago in 2013 when another very drastic law passed in Texas, shutting down the majority of the clinics in the state. And for all intents and purposes, Roe v. Wade was non-existent. We also experienced it last year when the governor issued executive orders that basically made abortion illegal. And so we've been there before. It's very upsetting to have to tell people that they're not able to get safe legal services in their communities and having to leave their home state to get care elsewhere.
And when we're talking about it, we're talking about 6 weeks, and this is when a fetal heartbeat can be determined. When you look at who gets an abortion in Texas, are we talking about most abortions then being illegal because of this new law?
Yes, you know, the majority of people, about maybe 86% of people find out they're pregnant after 6 weeks. And so we're talking about the majority of people that need to have abortion services will have to leave the state because it would be illegal here.
And what is when we're talking about who gets an abortion in Texas, are we talking about young people? Are we talking about low income people, people of color? Help us understand.
We see people from all walks of life, all kinds of backgrounds, all kinds of support systems. The big difference here is that the people that have resources and means will be able to travel outside of the state and get the services they need. It's people living in poverty, disproportionately Black and brown people that will pay the consequences, because we won't have we don't have the same resources as others to be able to travel outside of the state and make all of the accommodations and all the logistical obstacles that already exist that are imposed by the state of Texas in order to have an abortion.
And we're talking about even someone who has been raped or is the victim of incest. I just want to make sure our listeners understand what that means. Can you expand on that, Andrea?
Yeah, this is a very cruel law for everyone. There are no kinds of exceptions. This is a law that applies to everyone.
Applies to everyone. Right. Are you surprised at all by what the Supreme Court decided this week?
I am. I guess I was hopeful that we were going to get relief, that I still have faith in justice, in our justice system. And I was really hoping that we would have a better outcome. And so I think that myself, as well as the majority of Texans, are disappointed and still in shock.
Do you plan to fight this or fight the law as it stands now?
We are right now assessing and talking with our counsel and strategizing as to what are the different venues we can approach. Unfortunately, in the state of Texas, you can't separate reproductive rights from politics. You have to, in order to practice medicine, you have to be part of engage in litigation, which is really unfortunate. And so this is something that we'll continue to do. We are not only healthcare providers, but we're also reproductive rights defenders, and we'll continue to fight to protect our rights.
And what has been the response from outside of Texas to what is happening inside your state?
There's been a lot of support and a lot of outrage as well. I mean, I think that people realize that what happens in Texas doesn't stay in Texas, and that this sets a precedent for other states to pass similar laws.
And how many clinics are there in Texas now?
I believe there's approximately 22 clinics in the state of Texas.
And at what point? There were many more than that not so long ago, correct?
That's correct. Before the previous law, HB2, was enacted in 2013, there was approximately 52 clinics in the state. Throughout the process of the litigation of the case, Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt, a lot of clinics closed. At one point in time, there were maybe 3 clinics in the whole state. And after the Whole Woman's Health victory in 2016, about half of the clinics have been able to open. And so we are at about 20 to 22 clinics, which is less than 50% of what the access to care was before these harmful laws were enacted.
Do you suspect or believe that the intent of this law is essentially to put you out of business because someone, a stranger, could sue anyone at your clinic, I'm assuming including you, for $10,000 per abortion?
Yes, I think that the tactics have been clear for the last 15, 20 years, where the state of Texas continues to pass these restrictions and regulations that make it more and more difficult, chipping away at the rights to access safe and legal abortion. And this has been one of the most drastic examples.
Have you faced harassment as a result of this law, or is it too soon to tell?
We have. On September 1st, we had a lot of anti-choice advocates and protesters outside of our clinics with shining lights, intimidating our patients and our staff. We have received complaints by anti-choice organizations that have been filing complaints. And so we have been experiencing a lot of harassment.
How do you stay safe under those circumstances?
Absolutely. Safety is, it's paramount for ourselves, our staff, and our patients. We are taking all of the necessary precautions, but we won't leave our people alone. We will be there to support our community, and so they can count on us.
Are you worried that staff might just feel that they are too at risk or too vulnerable and they don't want to do this work anymore?
I think that we all feel that fear, but I think our commitment to our communities, to our patients, to our values is stronger than that fear.
And at your clinic, it's surgical abortions. Is it also medical abortions? Does that take place at the clinic as well?
Yes.
And when it comes to medical abortions, my understanding is that people can order those medicines online. Do you see that as a future for people that want to have an abortion?
I think that's an alternative. I think that there are many resources that offer that possibility. But I think it's important to for people to have a variety of options. And while for some people it may be simple for them to order this medication online or get this medication virtually, other people want the support that they can get at a clinic. People want to be able to talk to our staff and our counselors and be able to have that interaction. And I think people are being robbed of that opportunity.
Why do you do this work?
This is the work of my life. This is my redemption, my everything. This is important work. This is work that comes from the heart. One of my most important values is the sense of altruism. And I want to be able to help people in any way that I can, especially when it comes to reproductive rights.
And are you, as you said, what happens in Texas may not stay in Texas. Are you concerned that other states will look at Texas and enact similar laws?
I am concerned. I think that's very possible. And I think that, unfortunately, Texas has become sort of the model state for VAT regulation when it comes to reproductive rights. And so I am very fearful of that.
Are you also fearful of people essentially harming themselves doing what now are illegal abortions in Texas?
Very much, very much. I think, as we mentioned earlier, I think that a smaller percentage of people will be able to have the resources to travel out of state, but that's not the reality for the majority of people. And at a moment of desperation, people may take action into their own hands, and that could be a dangerous situation.
And what are your next options? I'm looking at the clock here. We have about 45 seconds or so, but what are your next options, and frankly, options for other abortion providers in Texas?
I think at this point we are evaluating with our council what other strategies and what other venues we can take. But one thing I know is the commitment from all abortion providers in Texas is unwavering, and we're going to be here for our patients.
Well, Andrea Farigno, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And she is vice president of Whole Women's Health, which operates 4 abortion clinics in Texas, talking about this law that went into effect this week. Coming up, we'll be talking about some of the legal and constitutional implications of this Texas law, also the Supreme Court's decision earlier this week. And we want to hear from you. Any questions or comments, reactions, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me just recap here. In the middle of Wednesday night, in an unsigned brief, the U.S. Supreme Court gave Texas the go-ahead to enact the strictest abortion law in the country that violates the provisions of Roe v. Wade and Casey. It essentially outlaws abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, including for rape and incest. It also empowers private citizens anywhere, not the state government, to enforce the ban. It allows them to sue anyone involved with performing an abortion after 6 weeks or anyone who aids or abets the abortion, be they a family member, a friend, a clinic receptionist, or even someone who drives a woman to a clinic. The private citizen would be entitled to $10,000 per abortion plus legal costs. 5 justices said those challenging the law did not make their case. Chief Justice Roberts, who broke with the majority, said he would have blocked the law while it was being appealed. Justice Sotomayor was more outspoken, saying the Texas law was flagrantly unconstitutional, engineered to prohibit women from exercising their constitutional rights and evade judicial scrutiny. Joining us and here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Kimberly Mutcherson. She's co-dean and professor of law at Rutgers Law School across the river in Camden. Her scholarly work is at the intersection of family law, health law, and bioethics. Kimberly Mutcherson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me again.
You're welcome.
Marie.
Absolutely. David S. Cohen is with us as well. He's a professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law, co-author of Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America. David S. Cohen, nice to have you back with us as well.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Where to begin? Well, let's just begin with Roe v. Wade. As it stands now, can we say that Roe v. Wade applies, Kimberly, to 49 states and the District of Columbia, but not Texas?
I think that's fair to say, right? I mean, there was a sort of big debate going on Twitter about whether we should talk about Roe as being overruled, and it hasn't technically been overruled, but certainly in Texas right now, it's as if Roe and Casey don't exist.
You agree with that, David?
Yeah, I mean, for most patients in Texas who are seeking an abortion, Roe v. Wade is a paper right, but not a reality. There's a small sliver of patients, as Andrea was telling us, who can get an abortion before 6 weeks, but it's really a tiny percentage. For everyone else, they can say Roe is the rule of the law or rule of the land, but it doesn't do them any good.
Well, and I don't want to get bogged down in some of this legalese and constitutional issues, but nonetheless, if I can go back to you, Kimberly, this was a shadow docket decision. It was unsigned. Five of the justices agreed with it, but unsigned. The dissenters did sign their name to their disagreements. What's the significance of that?
Well, first of all, the only way we know that it was a 5-4 decision is because of the four dissenters who chose to write separately. And, you know, the concern about the shadow docket is the court is sort of making decisions without making decisions. So there was no oral argument here. We didn't have briefing on the merits. And so the court basically is and has in the last several years been using the shadow docket to make these really momentous decisions without the kind of care that we would expect from the highest court in the land.
What does that tell us about this court?
It tells us that they are using this tool, this shadow docket, really to implement Republican policies. I mean, if you look at the topics that they've ruled on with the shadow docket, COVID restrictions, immigration, eviction, death penalty, abortion, election reform, the result in all of those cases on the shadow docket corresponds with the party line of the Republican Party. They are adopting Republican Party principles without argument, without briefing, and really without much thought, and sometimes without any explanation.
But it's so confusing because is this law unconstitutional? I mean, Justice Sotomayor, Kimberly, says this is unconstitutional.
Of course. And Texas knew it was unconstitutional when they passed it, right? I mean, we were seeing this constantly coming out of state legislatures. You know, Casey was very clear. Casey was unclear on a lot of things. But one of the things that was clear was it rejected the trimester framework of Roe and gave us a viability standard. And no one thinks that viability starts at 6 weeks. No one thinks that viability starts at 15 weeks, which is the next case that's going to go up to the Supreme Court.
The Mississippi case, right.
So it's very clear that these laws are being passed with complete understanding that they are violating the existing law under Roe and Casey. And that's the goal, right? The goal is to get back up to the Supreme Court and get the Supreme Court to say Roe and Casey are dead letter.
You're saying that's by design, on purpose, in order to take this back
Absolutely.
Up to the court, a much more conservative court than we've had in recent yeah. years.
I mean, one thing I'll say about this bill is that there's a level of sophistication that's really frightening about the thought process that went into trying to create an unconstitutional piece of legislation that would also be able to avoid being reviewed by the Supreme Court. That's pretty terrifying.
And that's because private citizens are, in a sense, deputized to carry out the law.
Almost every other abortion law that's ever been written, the state enforces it, meaning the state attorney general or local district attorneys or licensing bodies. So that means that abortion clinics or providers or even patients, when they want to go on the offensive to sue to stop the law from ever taking effect, they sue the state officials. And they say, because this law is unconstitutional, you, state official, cannot enforce this law. And that's how the law is struck down as unconstitutional, because this Texas law says the state is not involved in enforcement. Rather, private individuals, any private individual, can file a lawsuit. It creates this procedural mess in terms of, well, who does the clinic sue ahead of time to stop it from ever taking effect? And, you know, it's a mess that can be resolved, should have been resolved by the Supreme Court because it was so blatantly unconstitutional. But basically, they threw their hands up in the air and they said, who are we to solve these complex problems? We can't do that. So let's just let this law take effect. I mean, they basically wrote, I think it was 12 sentences that said, oh, these are really tough issues. Oh, well, sorry. That's the bottom line.
Are we talking, though, Kimberly, about vigilante justice? I mean, you're putting essentially the law in the hands of the public, of potentially perfect strangers who are not in any way personally harmed by an abortion. They may oppose abortion, but it doesn't affect them personally.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the language that Justice Sotomayor used in her dissent is really important, right? She said the state has basically created bounty hunters who can go out and find people who are either, you know, providing abortion services or aiding and abetting, which, of course, isn't defined in the statute. And then you get $10,000 when the suit is over. And that's just incredibly frightening to think about. Given, and David certainly can talk about this, given how vociferous the anti-choice folks are in a lot of these states, the risks here are really significant.
Well, I think they're ready to go, right, David?
Yeah, I mean, they already have a web form up online. You can fill in tips about illegal abortions. But, I mean, they're an organized movement. They certainly have high influence in the Texas politics and legislature. And they're ready to file lawsuits. And they can file lawsuits in any county in Texas. And we have a lot of counties here in Pennsylvania. I think we have 67. Texas has 254, I believe, a lot of with fewer than 10,000 people. And they can file the lawsuits anywhere the plaintiff lives, not where the abortion takes place, not where the clinic is, not where the person who gets the abortion lives, but where the plaintiff lives. So you get an anti-abortion extremist who lives in one of the smallest, most conservative counties in Texas that has conservative judges, and they can force the abortion provider or any of the aiders or abettors to defend themselves before that small-town anti-abortion judge. I mean, it's bounty hunting and choose your forum in the most hostile forum possible.
And this issue of having standing, I mean, my very, you know, unsophisticated view of the law, I always thought, well, you had to have standing in order to be able to take a case. It has to affect you personally.
Yeah, I mean, this is a basic premise of law, which is that in order to file a lawsuit, you have to be harmed. If you and I get into a car accident, Kim can't sue you for the car, one of us for the car accident, because she wasn't harmed. But in Texas, under this law, they throw that out the window and they say anyone can sue. Not just, you know, it's not like it's limited to family members who disagree or something. It can be someone sitting on their couch in Montana who says, I don't like abortion in Texas and I'm going to file a lawsuit. Anyone anywhere can file this lawsuit, and it's unlimited in terms of the number of people who can sue.
And you're not going to sue the woman getting the abortion. You can sue the doctor or the secretary who works there, or perhaps the guard who works at the clinic, or the brother-in-law who maybe had a conversation. I'm looking at you, Kimberly. Maybe had a conversation and said, yeah, you know, you're entitled to have an abortion. Or someone, you know, God forbid they're the victim of rape and incest, and let's say they're 8 weeks pregnant.
Right. I mean, the expansiveness of this law is really quite shocking, frankly. And what we'll see in the next few days, given that it was allowed to go into effect, is that there will be lots of women and other pregnant people in Texas who end up carrying pregnancies to term because they can't go elsewhere in order to terminate those pregnancies for a whole range of different reasons. So, you know, Texas has really hit on a scheme that is not just problematic in the context of abortion. Frankly, we should be concerned about a scheme like this being used in a whole host of different ways.
Well, Interesting you said that. I'm looking at the opinion page, an editorial by the very conservative Wall Street Journal, just quoting a couple lines. This law is a misfire, even if you oppose abortion, and neither side should be confident the law will be upheld. It goes on to say the law sets an awful precedent that conservatives should hate. Could California allow private citizens to sue individuals for hate speech, or New York deputize private lawsuits against gun owners? Is that the potential slippery slope?
Absolutely, right? I mean, so one would hope that this would be a very sticky slope and not a slippery slope. But if the court allows this kind of thing to go forward, there's no reason to think that there aren't state legislatures in red states and blue states and purple states that will come up with similar types of schemes in order to move forward their own agendas.
I think we're already seeing that, aren't we, David?
Florida, the president of the Florida Senate yesterday said that he wanted to fast-track legislation like this in Florida. Florida is another large state with a lot of abortion providers, and this would be devastating to the people of Florida. And combine Florida and Texas, and you've basically devastated abortion provision in the entire South. It would be really crippling.
Let me just throw something back at you, Kimberly, only because we were talking about this before going on the air. And I said, you know, what is the precedent for, in a sense, deputizing perfect strangers to carry out a law? You said the Fugitive Slave Act. Can you expand on that? And then I want to read a bunch of comments here.
Sure. I mean, I want to just be clear. My friend Michelle Goodwin, who is an amazing person, who is a professor at UCI Law School, she was asked a very similar question. And her response was the Fugitive Slave Act, right, is an example of an act that essentially said you as a private person, if you see someone or apprehend someone who is a fugitive enslaved person, you can get that person and then you can bring them in and then you can get paid for doing that, right? It's horrifying to think of that. Of course, there are other sorts of laws that allow, you know, private citizens to have a right of action, whether it's, you know, if you've been injured by a police officer or environmental acts, but those are all assuming that there has actually been harm to you and that you can therefore get a remedy for it. That's not what this law is saying at all.
Let me just toss out a couple of comments here. Stephanie asks, on what basis do private individuals who are deputized by the new Texas abortion law have legal standing to sue providers and other potential defendants under that law? I mean, this is the question that's hanging over this whole conversation.
The reality is the basis is that the law says they do. The Texas legislature has said in this kind of a case, these are the people who can sue. And it will be, you know, eventually when these cases work their way through the Texas courts will have to answer the question, can the legislature create such broad standing? And I'm no expert on Texas standing law. This will be decided under Texas law, not federal law. And so maybe the Texas courts say this goes too far. Maybe not. It's, you know, Texas has a conservative court system, a conservative state Supreme Court. So they might say this is allowed. But the reality is that until we get a decision saying otherwise, this law allows people who have not been harmed to sue. And that, you know, I think the comment gets to the point, this is unique in American law.
And is there a way to push back? I mean, I'm trying to imagine. Well, let me ask you, because you've been writing a lot about the abortion issue in this country. Would you say that those who oppose abortion have been essentially smarter legally, constitutionally, than those who support abortions?
I wouldn't go with smarter. I would go with they've been able to be more effective in getting their policies enacted by the legislators in the states where they have support. Only recently have we seen blue states passing laws that pro-choice people have been suggesting to increase access. And it's a very small number of blue states that are doing that. But we've seen for decades now that anti-abortion folks have been very effective at convincing state legislators and some federal legislators to pass whatever they want. Basically, they hand them a model bill and they say, pass this, and they do it. And this one is very clever. As Kim was saying earlier, it's very clever. It's designed specifically to avoid attack. And so it's novel and clever, but basically they're effective. They have the ear of the legislators, and the legislators do what they want.
Here's an email from PJ. Is there a dormant commerce clause? Is this a dormant commerce clause violation? I don't even know what that means. Texas is diverting their abortion patients to nonprofit clinics or of neighboring states. Could that be seen as burdening interstate commerce?
I'm going to point to David. He's the con law professor for dormant commerce clause questions.
I teach dormant commerce clause every year, and I introduce the topic by telling my students, I'm sorry, I'm going to bore you for the next two classes.
Well, basically, I'll give you a minute.
It's a principle that says that states cannot discriminate against interstate commerce. So Pennsylvania can't say, we don't want New Jersey tomatoes, right, coming across our border. And it unifies the country. So Texas's law, I don't think, implicates it in the sense that it's not discriminating against interstate commerce. It may be increasing interstate commerce by sending patients out, but the law itself is not a requirement that that happens. That's an effect of it. So I don't think it raises those issues. It does raise issues of interstate travel generally.
Right.
And I think this is something that we might see if Roe is overturned. Patients traveling across the country, patients with means who are traveling across the country to get abortions, and I think it will be a tricky issue eventually. Will states be able to punish people who cross state lines to get an abortion that's legal, say, in New Jersey, but illegal, say, in Texas? I think that's on the horizon.
We're almost up on a break here, Kimberly, but I'm thinking of patients without means. I mean, these are the people who are going to bear the brunt, frankly, of these
laws.
I mean, because they don't have the means to be flying around the country to get an abortion.
Exactly. And, you know, the other thing is, even if they did have the means to fly around the country to get an abortion, you're changing when they get to have an abortion, right? And so if I have to accumulate more money because I have to leave, then maybe that first trimester abortion becomes a second trimester abortion, which is, one, more expensive for me, and two, is more risky in terms of my health and safety as a pregnant person. So, you know, the risks that are being created here are risks that are sitting very squarely on the bodies of women and other pregnant people.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Kimberly Mutcherson. She's co-dean and professor of law at Rutgers Law School in Camden. David S. Cohen with us as well, professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. And we are talking about the Texas law that the U.S. Supreme Court greenlit earlier this week. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moss Cohen, just giving you a chance to catch up with our conversation here. We're talking about the fact that earlier this week, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to block a Texas law that prohibits most abortions after 6 weeks, even in cases of rape and incest. It also allows citizens to sue anyone who performs an abortion or, quote, aids or abets an abortion and can recoup or get something like $10,000 per case. And again, we are talking with law professors Kimberly Mutcherson and David S. Cohen. David, one thing you wanted to say, and just to our listeners, we're here in Pennsylvania, a sizable state, but Texas is a really big state. Why does that matter?
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking a lot about travel and how the option for patients to travel if they can't get a procedure in Texas. It's really hard to understand just how large Texas is, especially here in the Northeast where our states are relatively small. Texas is monstrous. I mean, it's over 1,000 miles to drive across it east-west, let alone north-south. And also the southern part of Texas, the Rio Grande Valley, is the second poorest area in the country, second to Appalachia. So we've got really low-income people, not many resources, really far away from any other state. So the idea that, okay, well, you can't get an abortion in Texas, just go to Louisiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, for people in particularly in southern Texas, that's just not going to happen. They won't have the means to get there. It will take forever to drive there. It's the geography of Texas and the poverty of Texas just make this law even more insidious.
And Medicaid doesn't cover abortions, correct?
Right. Texas is one of the states where Medicaid does not cover abortion.
Here's a question from Samantha. I'll put this to you, Kimberly. She says, will people who donate to charities that facilitate abortion access, such as the National Network of Abortion Funds and the National Abortion Federation, be liable to be sued under this new law? What do you think?
It's written so broadly that it seems to sweep in pretty much everybody, right? The person who, like, buys you coffee in the morning as you're going, you know, to the clinic. It's really quite, again, it's quite frightening how expansive this piece of legislation is. And the idea that it was allowed to actually go into effect is shocking to me.
Here's another question from Casey. The Constitution puts the burden of proof on the state, not the individual. If someone brings a false accusation against a doctor using this law, is there any recourse for the doctor to recover legal expenses from the accuser? And this is getting into the weeds, but this is significant.
No, these are important weeds because this law is, and this is a legal term, bonkers in so many different ways, not only because of the enforcement mechanism we're talking about, but the legal fees part of it. If a doctor is sued and loses, the doctor has to pay the attorney's fees for the plaintiff. But the law specifically says that if a plaintiff sues a doctor and the doctor wins, the doctor cannot recover attorney's fees. So the only one who can recover attorney's fees is the anti-abortion extremist who wins. This is specifically, you know, this is just another way that this law is meant to damage abortion provision.
I mean, it seems, Kimberly, there's so many legal constitutional ways to challenge this law. How would that work?
Well, I mean,
what do you need, I guess, is another way to put that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's so challenging about this is that we're not even at the merits, right? We're not even sort of talking about how a heartbeat bill or a ban, you know, at 6 weeks violates Roe and violates Casey, because we're doing all these early conversations about who could even be a proper defendant. And that's what's so pernicious about what they've done here. Because if we can't get to court because we can't sue anybody, then we don't even get to have a conversation about the fact that the substance of the law actually is unconstitutional. The idea that, again, the idea that the U.S. Supreme Court would let that stand is, as David says, bonkers.
Well, so what options, I mean, do providers have or people who support abortion?
So the most straightforward option is that a doctor or someone who aids and abets will be sued in state court, and they will raise as a defense that this lawsuit is unconstitutional, and as a result, this law is unconstitutional. And they will raise that as a defense in Texas state courts. That will then work its way through the Texas court system, and ultimately that would be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And then somewhere along the line, hopefully, someone strikes it down as unconstitutional because it's so clearly unconstitutional. There are a couple problems with that. One, there's this Mississippi case sitting out there that we've alluded to, that the Supreme Court is considering a ban at 15 weeks from Mississippi. They are arguing that case either in December or January of this term. They will decide by June. So it's possible by the time one of these lawsuits makes its way up, Roe could be overruled, in which case there would be no constitutional defense. But even if there is a constitutional defense, right now in Texas, none of the abortion clinics are providing abortion over 6 weeks.
Right.
They are following the law.
Right.
Now, the catch-22 is that because they're following the law, no one's going to sue them. And so if no one sues them, the law stays in effect because there can't be a challenge. And if the law stays in effect, then they continue to stop providing abortion at 6 weeks. So it's just this endless cycle that the law has an effect without a challenge. It's just, right. You know, maybe there will be a provider who decides, I'm going to publicly flout the law in order to bring a lawsuit against me and then start it going in state court. That happened before Roe v. Wade. A doctor in Minnesota, Jane Hodgson, performed an abortion that was against the law very publicly, and she was prosecuted, and that started some of the litigation that ultimately wound its way to the Supreme Court. That's not happening yet in Texas, mm-hmm. but maybe it will.
Talk to us about the Mississippi case, Kimberly, because this, as David said, this will be argued before the U.S. Supreme Court in the next couple of months. What do we need to know about that?
Yeah. So the Dobbs case is the one that we all had our eyes on, which, as David said, is a 15-week ban, which, again, under Roe and Casey, is unconstitutional. You know, the thing that's scary is that these are issues that have been decided. Right. I mean, it's not as if there's this huge circuit split and we just have to figure out, you know, what the rules are here. These things have been decided. So the fact that the court keeps taking these cases is not a good sign for anybody. And, you know, and I'll say certainly that my as we were thinking about what the world was going to look like once we had Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court, you know, my prediction was it will be a continuous slow chipping away at Roe and Casey. And that was my expectation of what would have and may still happen in Dobbs.
And at issue is this whole issue of viability, right? I mean, that's what Roe did. And Casey was more about undue burden, correct?
Well, Roe actually was much more protective in the sense that it had this trimester framework, right? So first trimester, you can't do anything. Second trimester, you can legislate in terms of the health of the pregnant woman. And then third trimester, you could go as far as to ban. And then once we got to Casey, the court said that trimester thing, that doesn't make any sense to us. Now we're just going to use viability as the line, which is also problematic, right? I mean, viability is not some sort of static number. It has shifted in our lifetimes and will continue to shift in our lifetime. But even so, under that undue burden standard that got created in Casey, a ban at 6 weeks or a ban at 15 weeks is blatantly unconstitutional. There's no way around it.
Agreed?
Yeah, I mean, these laws were written to be direct challenges, and they were done in conjunction. It's a real full court press here. Pass these laws you know are unconstitutional while also trying to pack the court with anti-abortion justices, because eventually these laws will be challenged. So eventually, hopefully, one of them will be challenged when the court eventually has a slate of anti-abortion justices. And thanks to the election of Donald Trump in 2016, because of fate and political will and retirements, he got to appoint three justices. He told us publicly that right. He was going to appoint anti-abortion justices who will, quote unquote, automatically overturn Roe v. Wade. And he appointed three very conservative Republicans. And now we have a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court. Even if Chief Justice Roberts moderates.
And he was with the
dissenters the other night. Even if he moderates, then we still have five conservatives who, by all accounts, are anti-abortion. It's just a question that Kim said, are they going to get rid of Roe entirely this time around, or are they going to chip away?
Well, and just to add to that, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland, even though he had 9 months, I think, left on his term as president of the United States. And then when Trump had, about a month left, rush Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that is most disturbing in some ways about this case and about what the court looks like now is that there's not even sort of a patina that this is not a political branch, right? The idea that during these confirmation hearings, people are asked these questions, they refuse to answer because that case might come in front of us. But then they make all these claims about stare decisis and how important it is and following settled law. But the moment they get an opportunity to change that settled law, that's what they do. So the idea that we have some sort of, impartial U.S. Supreme Court that is making these decisions is laughable at this point.
Let me read some more comments. Stephen says, by enacting a law which is enforced by vigilantes, Texas has paved the way for other vigilante-enforced legislation. Steve says, how does the Texas government defend their decision to essentially ban abortion? Is it based on religious beliefs? If that's true, I was sure that the church and state should be separated. What is the logic here? David, any response to that?
I mean, they say they're pro-life. They say they will do everything they can to ban abortion. Some of them say it's based on religion, maybe a lot of them. It's longstanding law in this country that just because a law happens to also have a basis in religion, such as, say, a murder law, doesn't mean the law is unconstitutional, because there can be secular reasons, too. But they are upfront that they want to ban abortion, and they're trying everything they can to do it. And so this law is consistent with what they're saying. And the irony of it is that they say they're pro-life, and yet Texas doesn't have mask mandates, doesn't have vaccine mandates, has really not taken COVID seriously. The death rates are high. So the pro-life statement is really just hiding behind an anti-woman, anti-autonomy, anti-dignity principle here, because they're not. It's not a pro-life state.
And can I just add one thing to that,
though? Sure.
Particularly on the pro-life issue. Texas is also a state that has an incredibly high maternal mortality rate, right? So on one hand, we're out here and we're supposedly saving babies as women are dying at the rate that you would see in developing countries when they give birth. That's a problem, right? So you can't call yourself a pro-life state when you are content to, you know, eviscerate a social safety net and then to watch women die in pregnancy, particularly Black women and brown women.
Chris asks, how isn't this law a HIPAA violation when evidence from these vigilantes is presented in court? Isn't all individual health information private? Similarly, Greg says, how could an outside party know what happens in a clinic between a doctor and a patient? I mean, these clinics are regulated, Kimberly. So, I mean, this is a health procedure.
So let me say one thing about HIPAA. HIPAA does not mean that no one can ever talk to you about your health information, right? So that's why this vaccine stuff that people are talking about, none of that is actually covered under HIPAA. Now, it would be one thing if somebody, say, snuck into a doctor's office and was rifling through their files. But that's not our expectation. That certainly isn't the Texas expectation of what would happen here, right? So you're talking about somebody... It's word of mouth, right? Oh, I know that so-and-so just took his girlfriend to have an abortion. That's all you need. And that's not a HIPAA violation because it's not about releasing information that was given to your physician or healthcare provider. So HIPAA's not going to cut it here.
Let me go back to you, David. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is talking about some kind of legislation. I mean, we've been watching our Congress at work, you know, wondering whether any kind of legislation that protected abortion rights could make it through this Congress or, frankly, any Congress.
I mean, look, if the House of Representatives passes a law that protects abortion rights, that would be an incredible symbolic victory. But that's all it would be, because we know it will die. It won't even get an airing in the Senate. The Senate with the filibuster, let alone the fact we don't have 50 Democrats who are pro-choice, is not going to pass this law. So legislation from the federal government, it would be great, but it's not happening. Can the federal regulatory state, the executive branch under Biden, do anything? Now, Biden announced yesterday that he was going to have a full court press looking at all the options for the federal regulatory state. And I hope he does. And I hope they're creative, because there might be some creative things the FDA can do or other agencies can do. But it's going to take a lot of strategy and a lot of bold action, frankly, bold action that the Democrats have not usually been willing to take. The Republicans, sometimes this feels like asymmetric warfare here, where the Republicans are willing to go out on a limb and take really bold, creative, possibly illegal action, but they're going to try. And the Democrats are more timid. It's going to take matching what Texas did with that kind of creativity. I hope we see it. I'm not so optimistic.
You're nodding your head. We're almost out of time. Go ahead, Kimberly.
Yeah, I think what I would add to that is I'm not optimistic about the federal level at all. I'm much more optimistic about what individual states might do. So, for instance, I live in New Jersey, and we've had a bill that's been floating around, which is a Reproductive Freedom Act, that would really codify the right to abortion and including a right to financial assistance in getting an abortion. So I think that we will see that kind of proactive legislation in some jurisdictions. But again, that doesn't help women and other pregnant folks in states like Texas. Pennsylvania, I would imagine, is not going to be a great place. And so that's going to be a problem.
Well, we have to leave it there. Let me just add a comment from BJ, who says, not one word about the unborn child's right to life in this program. Shame on WHYY. Kimberly Mutcherson, thank you for joining us on Radio Times. And David S. Cohen, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And we appreciate all those comments and questions that we had. You can go to WHYY.org to get more information about Radio Times if you look under programs. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcast. Tina Calloway and Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.